You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting artists in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. On this episode, we have a fascinating chat with Pharoah Monch. Pharoah has been spitting some of the most intricate and meaningful lyrics in all of rap since his first release in 1991 with the duo Organized Confusion. He took the polysyllabic rhyme style pioneered by Kool G Rap, combined it with a political critique reminiscent of early 90s Chuck D and Ice Cube, and added his own unique poetic imagination to create a style unlike anything before or since. After three superb albums with Organized Confusion, Pharoah went solo in 1999 with Internal Affairs, a record which spawned the monster hit Simon Says. Since that time, he has continued to release adventurous music that follows his uncompromising vision. Pharoah's next release later this year will be an EP called PTSD, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. I began my talk with Pharoah by asking him his feelings about the downfall of Rupert Murdoch's son, James. Murdoch was forced to resign his job at his father's News International Corporation after being implicated in the company's notorious phone hacking scandal. But years ago, that same James Murdoch was also one of the founders of the seminal hip-hop record label Raucous Records, a company with which Pharoah had a very difficult relationship.
I mean, on one side, you're like, good for you. On one side, you're like, you know, it's so above and beyond where my frame of mind is financially and just focus is right now. I haven't even been giving it any thought to care emotionally one way, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm. Because I know you had, you've been public about your feelings about the label in the past.
Yeah.
Excellent. I thought there might be some Schadenfreude there. I wanted to, you know, kind of go back to the very beginning with you. The intro on the very first Organized Confusion album. You situate the group real firmly in old school Hip-hop. You have this whole, like, lime to a lemon kind of thing. It's very callback to the early Channing days. But on that record, the flows and the concepts and stuff you use are very different than that. And I was just wondering, what do you see in early hip-hop, late 70s, early 80s hip-hop, that connects with you or, you know, connected at least with you then at the beginning of your career?
Just for me, it was more, like, the routines and, like you said, the camaraderie. Mm-hmm. It was more groups, and so that's what was attractive, you know. So we tried to mimic that feel. Mm-hmm. The simplicity along with the complex of doing the routines together and how that felt vibe wise at like park jams and live concerts, just taking me and Prince back to the roots of what inspired us. We felt it would be a great way to start there. Mm-hmm. And then kind of jump around to the different, you know, flows that we were trying to implement. Because the whole thing, you know, one of the basic reasons was to, you know, kind of provide and give to the culture and you know, and we felt we could do that with flows. So that's really one of the main reasons we got into it, is to like elevate and give back to and belong to hip hop culturally.
Awesome. That's fantastic. The end, by the end of Organized Confusion, you guys were super ambitious. The Equinox album, which I love, in I think it's my favorite mm-hmm. of your records, it was really ambitious. You had the skits, you know, telling a story, but the songs were also self-contained. They were accessible and self-contained. And that's a pretty ambitious project, mm-hmm. you know, to do something that big. And I was just wondering, do you think that was successful? Do you think it was successful with that? And what did you learn by taking on something that big?
I think you always have a big challenge when you do concept albums. And our thing was to kind of always go against the grain, you know.
Yeah.
With bars and arrangements, it wasn't like we were not privy to what the math of songs were. We were, you know, doing that purposely.
Yeah.
So even with the Equinox, in terms of getting the population to latch on to and buy a record, we knew we were throwing a curveball and asking people to listen, you know, to something that was challenging. And so I think it was successful in that we wanted to still challenge the audience, but kind of ground ourselves here on Earth, mm-hmm. because we were like the space cadets and we kind of wanted to get back to planet Earth with that album.
Okay. Speaking of space and science and that kind of stuff, I recently talked to both Kool Keef and Invincible, both of whom in their own way are, like you, obsessed with science terminology, science lingo. Even as early as questions, you were talking about, you know, rhymes being like amino acids and that kind of stuff. What's behind your fascination with that kind of vocabulary?
You know, I guess it's just, for me, is who I am. You know, in school, I took to science and chemistry and biology and ace test on the periodic table of contents and found it interesting how different components made other different chemicals and so on and so forth. So, you know, it was just what struck me. Mm-hmm. Vocabulary wise and what I was interested in at the time and how to, you know, mix that all up into a verse or make it sound interesting.
Excellent. So you mentioned vocabulary there, and that is absolutely one of the things that I really wanted to talk about. You have this line, I'm on Soundman, you say I'm terrific with wordplay, specific with verbs. And it seems like you take a real pride in your vocabulary in a way that's different than other rappers. In fact, you're one of only two rappers, you and Jay, and one of only a few people I've ever heard use the word whom correctly in a lyric. You have that be careful with whom you mingle thing. Why is that kind of correct and sophisticated use of words so important to you? I mean, you know, for rappers it should be, but there are certainly a lot for whom it's not.
I think language in itself is just fascinating. Again, and I've always been big on vocabulary in the sense that words strike me and pique my curiosity. And if I don't know the word, I'll look it up. I always found that with PE and tribe and tip would drop, you know, a phrase or word here and I would be like, what? You know. And I thought that, for me, was dope with MCs when they could pull out words that people don't use in everyday, you know, conversation in hip-hop. And, you know, I find that intriguing. So as I'm reading or listening or watching film or, you know, I'll come across a word and I'm like, this word is interesting, but not just in the word, but in the phonetics and the amount of syllables and how it makes your mouth move can also be funny, you know, how a word sounds. And words are dope like that, you know.
Yeah, excellent. So speaking of, you know, big words, multi-syllable words, when you started out rapping, you know, back in or at least rapping professionally in the early 90s. Only, it was like Kool G Rap and only a few other people doing the multi-syllable rhyme thing. So I was wondering where, and you kind of came out with that fully formed on record anyway. Where'd you learn to do that?
I think early on, you know, I was blown away by like T. La Rock.
That's who Kool Keith cited too, was right. A big influence.
T. La Rock, just that joint blew me away. But then after that, like, all the praises and credit for me go to G-Rap.
Right.
You know, amongst, you know, a lot of others, but mainly G-Rap, and like what he was doing with words and chopping them up and was incredible to me. And the phonetics, the flow, and how he would package it all up into one verse.
Awesome. Talking about particularly golden age rappers like G-Rap, without getting too specific, you're of a particular generation of rappers. You're almost exactly the same age, within like a year or so on either side, as Busta, Nas, Common, Yasin, Black Thought, Questlove, Method Man. You know, there's a long list. While there are exceptions like Jay-Z and Diddy, who are a little older, by and large, it seems to me that your generation is the first generation in hip-hop who've had career longevity while remaining relevant, not falling into this, you know, I'm only doing my old songs and, you know, on kind of the retro circuit or whatever. Why do you think your particular group managed to do this while the Golden Age people, who are obviously incredibly talented, like G-Rap or Rakim or whatever, haven't managed to do that?
Maybe a different perspective. I can speak for myself. I came in a music lover, as I'm sure others did, like, of many different genres of music. So one of the things I noticed about what I started to gravitate to, it was like, you know, Stevie and Zeppelin and Sabbath and Eugene McDaniels, and I'm like,
I love him. I was going to ask about him later.
And so I started to take a note of the era and why this music translated and moved me so much, and the longevity that it had. And so, you know, as you're digging, you know, I started to want to fashion myself like that. You know, I started making songs. I wanted to make songs that sounded like, how is this going to affect people 20 years from now, or when I'm not here anymore? And I want people to now, say, dig through files on the internet and discover a song with me and Mos, or me and Quali, or me and Gene, and be like, I didn't even know they worked together. Like, I would discover Miles and Coltrane or Ron Carter or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I would go try to find everything Ron Carter. So looking at the careers like that, I always look to the future of it. And it was never just a summer hustle, or it was an artistic excursion from the beginning that I saw, you know, long term.
That's interesting, because listening to your catalog, it seems to me lately, starting on the War record, you've been more overtly concerned about your legacy, at least as far as talking about it on record and talking about how will I be remembered and whatever. So, but it's interesting to hear you've been thinking about that from the very beginning. You mentioned Coltrane there a second ago. What's your relationship to saxophone players? That instrument in particular seems to be really important to you. Even on the first record, on Walk Into the Sun, you say the sax always seems to relax you, but at the same time it attacks you.
Well, Coltrane is a big influence, because a lot of the riffs, how they would affect me emotionally, and there are no words. I started to want to do that with my verses. So, and being indifferent to what the actual words were saying, I started to learn about tone. and tonality and all of those things. And he's the guy who did that for me and pushed me to challenge my breathing, thus pushing wordy overruns of verses and things of that nature.
Okay, excellent. There's one... So we've talked a bit about Organized. I wanted to deal with the very first solo record. On Internal Affairs, you mentioned right angles a bunch of times in this kind of philosophical, almost kind of mystical way. What's the importance of right angles to you?
Just mathematically, it's amazing how, you know, when you're at that angle, things are in balance, and then play on the word right, and then math, and how we're all made of numbers and equations and math, and how it correlates in it. You know, early on in these type of discussions, we would talk about how science and religion doesn't really mix, but around that time, I was kind of seeing how it actually does.
Okay. Excellent. Speaking of religion, and obviously you don't have to go into this to the extent you don't want to, I was kind of, you know, on Open Your Eyes, you say, sometimes I feel like I can't go on, but when I envision a black man with thorns in his hands on a crucifix, I get strong. Now, while you've included plenty of gospel-influenced music on your tunes, starting on the Desire record, that lyric is, so far as I could tell, the only open talk about Christianity in your whole catalog, other than, you know, some digs at the Catholic Church. So why did you not delve into that again? Is it your theology that changed, or your willingness to talk about it, or both?
I think that's where we were coming from. You know, Prince was heavily in the church. His father's a pastor. My family is out of the church from the South, and we thought it would be an interesting play with that Herbie Hancock loop to play that chorus in a gospel way and have it have a gospel feel. Again, writing that song, knowing that it's definitely going to go against the grain, but we had, like, swapped blood the promise to go against the grain. We started the group, so the song was heavily appreciated at the time, and then you look back on it, and it's you know, it's pretty bold.
Yeah.
Record. I remember it's one of the first records. Quali, you know, was like, "Yo, be like," I don't know what grade he was in or where he was at. He was like, "You guys made a gospel rap record, like, on your first, you know, album." Yeah.
And you've kept going with the gospel sound in your solo thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Which has been awesome. You mentioned Mos Def a second ago, and I wanted to talk to you about, you know, the whole Raucous era a little bit. That song, Oh No, you know, with Nate Dogg, came out right at the height of this whole Raucous underground, keep it real, you know, purist popularity amongst the fans, if not the artists. Like, I would definitely remember that vibe. So what was your reaction amongst your fans as, you know, one of the pillars of this underground, keep it real thing is doing a song with Nate Dogg? Like, what kind of reaction did you get to that? I remember, you know, from where I was sitting, it was kind of jarring.
Yeah, I've been kind of shielded and protected because I'm revered. So of late, a lot of people, I've been doing interviews, and even my manager just told me recently, like, "I hated y'all for doing that." And I'm like, what happened? You hate? And at the time, again, being totally honest, I was in a space where, you know, I was appreciating, you know, what was coming out of the West, Bob, and I was like, you know, MOP, like, just different.
Yeah.
Everything. So I'm like into everything. And so the label definitely is like, yo, we want y'all to do a joint together. Like, y'all need to do a song. I'm like, yeah, let's do a song together. This was the first time, you know, in my career where it was like I wasn't initiating the collaboration mm-hmm. on and Organized Confusion. It was mainly us, with the exception of OC and Q-Tip. Eternal Affairs was like me reaching out to all my favorite fucking artists. This, you know, of course I'm a Mos Def fan. It was no problem with that. But the misconception is like it was a contrived label thing.
Right.
Rockwilder, who did the beat, worked on the Equinox and Stress with us. And when the label was like, yo, we want to get Rockwilder to do the beat. Yeah. It was nothing to me because he was blowing up now with Jay-Z and working with all these artists that were on the radio. I'm like, Rock's my man from around the way.
Right.
And then Mos is my man from, you know, that's my people. So we got the beat, we picked the beat. Mos called me one night. He did the verse. I was like, wow, this is crazy. Yeah. And he was like, yo, I was thinking, and maybe, you know, you look at film or whatever, maybe the label told him to tell me to ease me, whatever. Yeah, I was thinking, we should put Nate Dogg on the chorus. I'm on the other end of the phone. I'm like, really? Not because I don't like Nate Dogg, because I'm like, I don't hear the classic Nate thing. Not because we won't work together, you know.
Yeah.
We can't do songs with artists from, like...
Right.
That wasn't my thought process.
Stand for something bad.
I didn't hear how it would work. Then when we got Nate on the chorus, I was like, Mos is a genius. This shit is brilliant to me. I thought the song was banging. I thought the song was brilliant. Song comes out, you know, guys are on tour. We're touring. I'm hearing whose verse do you like better, whatever. But I'm not hearing, I hate you guys for making this collaboration with the West Coast. I'm like, but not until recently, like, fans and people have come forward and been like, we hated you, but then we kind of liked it at the end of the day.
Yeah, I definitely remember that era. So you're from Southside, yeah. Right? And, you know, you've mentioned the Supreme Team a few times, glancingly, in your lyrics. Do you remember them from growing up?
Oh,
remember their heyday?
You can't be from Southside and not be a part of crack culture. It is a crack epicenter of everything crack cocaine. I mean, I'm like three blocks from South Road in Linden, mm-hmm. around the corner from Guy Al Brewer in Sutphin, and
What was your reaction when 50 started doing Ghetto Quran and talking so openly about that era on record?
I thought it was I thought the song was dope. I didn't know the inner workings with him at the time within that. I also knew it would be dangerous for him.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was. I mean, there are always rumors that that's what, you know,
it pretty
led
much.
To his...
Yeah. Being shot a bunch of times.
Yeah. Did you know him at all before he got
famous?
Yeah. So, there was one lyric of yours that I mean, there's a bunch, but there's one that really jumped out at me. You have this one line where you say... And they say, and I'm insane, because I see the remains of the whips and the chains. And I feel like that's a fascinating line. And I have a couple of questions about it. The first is, what do you see as the lingering effects of slavery? And second, I feel like this lyric ties into society's tendency to, like, pathologize people who are vehement about freedom, right? To say that you care about freedom so much, it's not that, it's that you're crazy. right? Right. John Brown went through that. Che went through that. Tons of, I mean, the list goes on and on. Have you experienced people thinking like, oh, that Pharaoh, he's just going on about that stuff. He must be crazy.
Definitely. That's the beauty about writing that way, is you know it will, people will view the book or the film in so many different aspects. And that's what I like about, I know I'm going off the topic, that's what I like about good movies and good books. You have a book discussion and, you know, you're like, how did you view this chapter or this character? Or you talk about the film and how did you perceive it? And things like that, you know, I see every day, even in terms of education and health issues and the disparity between getting an apple in the hood as opposed to when I'm in different neighborhoods and the food choices.
You have that line, the Whole Foods.
The whole gamut of the differences of ghetto. And so what's funny about writing sometimes you stumble upon metaphors and double entendres and so on and so forth. So with that line, at first, I was specifically talking about, I see the residue of slavery, whips and chains, which has also become slang, you know, which I admit to, like, it's not that deep of a stumble, but it grows in terms of like jewelry and cars and so on and so forth.
Excellent. As a related question, on 13, you say, you know, you're kicking the poor black shit. And it's unusual for a rapper to explicitly identify with the poor and not with the newly rich, right? Why is that so important to you?
For so many different reasons. There's a lot of soul. I even say, you know, Poe. Even the way that it's said denotes the conversation that happens in that arena is different and about different things. And even discussed in a different tone and rhythm. Not even being that deep with it politically, you know, just I can relate to that, and it's okay. Even saying poor instead of poor is fine, and the phonetics and the pronunciation is fine with me because my parents are from the South, so even a lot of Southern stuff where a lot of cats had a dispute, it didn't really bother me because, you know, I'm from that as well. And to this day, you know, where there's a high-end vocabulary, you know, I still turn to my manager and be like, I'm hungry. It's like, hungry? Like, what the fuck is that?
Nice. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings about P.E.? You covered Terradome. You freestyled over Shut Him Down, and you sampled Chuck's voice in the beginning of Internal Affairs.
Chuck was in that group, and you have to, I guess, discuss them, encompass the whole thing. Production and Flav was the first hip-hop music to give me goosebumps and make my hair stand up and make me shiver. And from that point, I started to study what really makes that happen. The goosebump theory, we called it. And what do you need to do? What do I need to do to make someone feel that or to have goosebumps? So, you know, obviously, you know, I looked at things that have done that to me in the past, like the Martin Luther King speech. Still from time to time I'll catch that and be like, woo. So I started to be like, okay, truth plus tone plus, you know, timing plus all these different things that could make somebody's hair stand up at a verse or lyric or the way that you're saying it. And so PE, you know, made me feel ways that I didn't feel about things. A lot of stuff I could relate to and struck a chord. And even in, you know, not so much political, just his tone with things made me inspired. So inspired to learn who these people were he was talking about, inspired to push forward and just be better. So after that point, you know, I was like, there has to be, you know, having a head that I have an equation for it. So I'm like, if you say something to someone that has so much honesty and so much truth, and the music strikes a chord, and there's harmonics, you could possibly make somebody's hair stand up.
Wow.
We'll be right back with the rest of our talk with Farrell Monch. You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. We began the second half of our conversation with Farrell Monch by asking the lifelong New York City resident about the differences in hip-hop's reaction to the city's past two mayors.
Bring it back to the first song I ever heard by you, which was Mayor off the Soundbomb 2 compilation. It's still one of my favorites. And that came out in the Giuliani era. Now, while plenty of rappers hated Giuliani, you know, there's certainly no shortage of hatred towards him, Bloomberg seems to have largely escaped that same kind of wrath. Why do you think that is?
He's a smart businessman, obviously.
Yeah.
And his rudeness and his kind of dark and same type of demeanor comes off quite a little differently and calculated and kind of like this is what needs to be done to run a successful corporation. So Bloomberg almost have people like he could diss the entire borough of Queens and he'll have people like, wait, is this necessary for the greater good of the...
Right.
And then you're like, yo, right. Fuck you, man, you know? What the fuck did you just say? Like, what are you, you know? So
yeah.
He's way more slick
right.
than Giuliani is, except for when he starts speaking Spanish. And I'm just like... Please, this is someone, stab him now.
Nice. Another mayoral type question. So What Is the Law and Fuck You, both those songs, present really awesome critiques of anti-gang laws, of what's called quality of life policing, all that kind of stuff. First, why put those ideas into the mouth of a racist cop, right? Why did you do that? Why do you think that would be effective? And also, what are your thoughts on New York City's top cop, Ray Kelly, potentially running for mayor?
You know, at this point, living in the city for so long, the words that come out of these people's mouths is just protocol, and I don't even think they, you know, it's just the order. You know, for anybody who doesn't know, you know, there just have been clear-cut cases where, you know, there's corruption and you'll hear, well, let's just wait until the, you know, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ, you shot the man 79 times. Like, yeah. That's not excessive, you know? Jesus. You know, not to laugh, but it's just like, you hear the same thing over and over, and you realize it's to create a tone for the department and for the people and have them feel a certain way about being governed and blase, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, on a lighter note, you deal with more with sex than most of your, a lot of your underground peers. And I was wondering, is that kind of a conscious choice to escape this image of this, like, deadly serious, I only talk about rhyming and, like, you know, sort of almost monastic kind of conscious MC image?
You know, I think the serious stuff is so serious that when you try to pull away into your other truths, it's kind of, for some people, it's like, nah. But to coin the keep it real thing, for me, it's like, it's all a lie if you're not encompassing all that you are and how silly you could be and how many times a day sex is on your mind and all of those things. So there's a conscious effort with artists to not go into that because it kind of starts to mess up the packaging.
Right.
I see a long time ago that I could have, you know, gotten a Hannibal Lecter thing and just played this whole packaging out with being like, you know, and packaged.
Yeah.
But again, that was something that organized confusion was against, you know, so we understand that business-wise it was kind of difficult to put the group in a box and package it, and I feel that same way, you know, with me and with artists in general, not to make me out to be different, you know, like my manager says, we agree on that. Like, artists can have this real great Purple Rain album that breaks records and everybody loves and there's a film for it. And then he goes back to the label and the label is like, we're thinking about calling the new album Lavender Snow, right. You know? And he's like, you know, like, I'm going to Madagascar to record wood instruments. And everybody's like, why don't you just keep doing what you're doing? But artists are like that. And we understand that it's difficult to box. I know I got off topic, but I talk about sex because if it's heavy on my mind at the time, it's like, why not make a song or drop a line or whatever? Yeah.
Definitely. Related to some of the stuff you were talking about artists being pigeonholed and stuff, on Let My People Go, use the word bamboozled. And that brought to mind a film that I just rewatched that is one of my absolute favorites and that your friend Yassine is in, which is, you know, Spike Lee's film of that name. Have you ever seen it? Like,
I watched it when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, as a story, as a whole, has left the grasp of my mind, but I know the gist of the story, which is why I use the term.
Excellent. It's definitely worth rewatching, and at most performances is absolutely hysterical. One other thing is, like, you were talking a second ago about, oh, you could have gone this whole, like, Hannibal Lecter sort of crazy guy route. And on right here, you have this line about you got advice to never act sane on a record of rap playing. So first off, is that actual advice? Sort of where did that come from? And second, do you think that is effective to, like, exaggerate your anger or paranoia or whatever on records?
It was just,
I mean, not that the advice they gave you rhymed at the time they gave
it. It's Cat from Harlem who we was in Organized Confusion. I had did the this chess rhyme where rook takes pawn, pawn takes rook.
Yeah.
Queen takes the original King James version, da 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 da. And he was a big chess player, and he was like, that verse, that line, that rhyme. And it blew him away, and he was like, you know, we were getting so much love in Harlem at the time, and he was like, yo, never dumb down your shit, because, you know, everybody up here right now is like on this song and fucks with you guys, even though you're Organized Confusion. Like, we had the Walking to the Sun record, and we would go to Harlem a lot, Willie Burgers and 145th, and basically he was saying, like, don't change what you do.
Wow. Awesome. So you did, obviously, famously, some writing for Sean Combs. Mm-hmm. What did it feel like to hear Diddy on the final record using not only your words, but also your cadence and a pretty good imitation of your voice? We can turn the camera off if you don't want to talk about it.
Oh, shit. Man. So I was working Pharrell Looks to Management. Like, should I tell this story? So I was working on Desire.
Yeah.
And it's dope because we landed a publishing deal, and we were on the same publishing company, and Puff was working on his album. And the young lady who signed me was like, yo, Puff, you know, reached out, wants you to write. So I was like, yo, again, like, misconception. Like, right. I met Puff years ago. Biggie was alive. We were at an event in Brooklyn. You know, Puff is the type of dude that keeps his pulse on what's happening. If he didn't, he wouldn't be who he was. So you would think that Puff wouldn't know who an Immortal Technique or J Electronica is, but of course. So we went to this meeting, you know, with Puff, and he's like, yo, I want you to work on the record. It's different. I got banging tracks and so on and so forth. And me being, you know, curious and wanting to find out a lot of things on my own on some Scorpio shit, was like, I saw this as a challenge, and it something that wouldn't be easy, actually. So first of all, it would be a challenge, and then a learning experience, because I was like, I've been on some big budget projects, you know, back in the days, even the underground projects had nice budgets.
Yeah.
But I've never worked on a $5 million album before. So in my mind, I'm like, I just want to see, you know, and learn from the process. But then he played me some music, and it was like Havoc tracks and Mr. Porter tracks, and already I'm like, oh, this is what Havoc gives to Puff and shit, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, cool. But what sealed the deal is he heard some of the stuff I was working on Desire, and really flipped over it, and we started a cool relationship. Flew down to Miami, and Puff was like, yo, don't change to what you've heard in the past from me. Do you, and be brutally honest with me. Brutally honest. If something's not right, I'm telling you to let me know. And I was like, all right, I'll do that. So we flew down to Miami, and I'm writing. And, you know, it's just coming out dope. Again, misconception. I've really learned a lot from him and working on that project. And one of the things was work ethic, which I had already began to take pride in my work ethic. But working with him, it was kind of like there are definitely different levels. You know, rewrites, you know, watching other people and just being around T.I. and different people and the work that he put into what he wanted to hear allowed me to go back to my project and ultimately be like, well, you worked that hard on that. You gotta do 150, you know, and go rewrite some stuff just because, you know, shit. So we wrote. He loved the songs. I laid, you know, some stuff and then I broke out. I went to Detroit to work with Mr. Porter on Desire, and we were working on like a trilogy, and then I get a call, and A&R is like, yo, I'm going to send you the first joint Puff did. He laid it. Everybody loves it. It's going to go to radio. It's crazy. It's, but you might want to hear it. I'm like, why does your voice sound like that, you know? So, sends me the record, and I'm like, oh, shit. Damn. Nah. I see what he's doing, but I think it's some things that, you know, we could change up, because he was kind of, in my opinion, spitting the rhyme like I would, but I didn't kind of lay it like that. So there was a artistic kind of discrepancy in that. I felt like it should be way more talkative, casual, and he, you know, was kind of rhyming it. And so I was like, nah, I'm going to fly back. I got to get this right. We got to get this right. So he was like, I'm going to get Puff on the phone with you. So I spent like 15 minutes, secretaries, hold. Who you want to speak to? Puff. Okay, hold. Who is it? Okay, hold. Okay, who would you want to speak to? Next person. 15 minutes, finally get Puff on the phone. What's up, son? You heard the joint? And I'm like, he said, be brutally honest.
Yeah.
I'm like, I think we could do it over. I think we could do it again. I think we could do it better. I think we could hit it again. I think we could go in and really get it.
Yeah.
He was like, I think you're wrong. I was like, so I'm like, you sure you love it? Yeah. He was like, I'm sure, you know?
Yeah.
And so record goes to radio. They're playing it all over New York radio and abroad. I get 100 phone calls from everybody in the hip hop industry. It's like, we know what song you wrote for Puffy. I'm like, hey, nah. But nah, you know, I think it's evident because of cadence and word choice or whatever, but for the most part, I wouldn't trade that experience, because his drive kind of took my drive to a different level.
Nice. One of the things I kind of wanted to get into was, you've definitely had some ideas. I don't quite know how to say it. Borrowed by other people, or you've had stuff that's influenced other people, particularly like, you know, the idea of a song from the point of view of a bullet, the idea of working King Crimson music from In the Court of a Crimson King into a song, which, you know, you did, and then that stuff from that same record showed up on Power. You've, of course, been singing and interpolating pop songs into your tunes since the beginning of your career. I guess, how do you feel when you hear an idea of yours, you know, borrowed, interpolated, used by other artists?
I mean,
yeah, I don't want to say that the S word, but, you know.
I mean, the first thing is I'm crazy, so I'm really under the belief that if you have an idea and you speak about it, you put it out there, that it does actually float around. And then there's some degree of, you know, with all the thousands and millions of MCs reaching for ideas, there's no way conceptually that you can, you know, have this thought process. And I have a funny story about that as well. And then, with the King Crimson joint, like, we had recorded that a minute ago, but it's no way that, you know, it wasn't out. So when I heard that record, I was just like, you know, now what do I do? Not more or less somebody bit my shit. Like, he's a beat genius. We were just the whole crew, me, the Gene. Yeah. We were all like, use the King Crimson shit. You know, and it was one of the songs. It was still a sample. We actually played it over.
Right.
But when it was still, you know, chopped, we were all like just bugging out over the feel of that vibe. So anyway, you think about, well, I think about how the ideas would translate under a major corporation green-lighted by the top people in the corporation rather than it coming from a grassroots situation. So, you know, and that's what you just deal with when you're a small boutique company. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, I got an idea for these new vegan cupcakes that will set Brooklyn on fire for my bakery. I just hope that Toastis doesn't fucking put out a vegan, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it feels like to me. In terms of the bullet joint, like, me and Nas had a conversation about that once. And it was funny because Nas was kind of telling me, like, in interviews, people was approaching him like, yeah, you know, somebody else, you know, and he started to be like, what the fuck? Like, me holla at dude, you know? So I think it's a matter of, you know, ideas, but I have been, you know, shit has been stolen from the God, man.
You know. It was an Earl Sweatshirt borrowed one of your lines for one of his tunes.
Yeah, I'm seeing that on a on a search. Like, yeah. I'll see somebody at him or whatever. I don't exactly know what it is, but like in those instances, you feel honored if you're a fan of the artist. You're like, he.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So you had a pretty vicious anti-Rock the Vote lyric a little while ago. So what are your current thoughts on voting, voter turnout drives, hip-hop's relationship to it, that kind of stuff?
I think voting is something that, for me, in each instance, the policies definitely matter. Mm-hmm. Overall, you know that the system, well, I know, I feel like the system is just overtly not going to individually change a movement. Mm-hmm. But then there are situations with certain causes and where it definitely matters who you voted for. Mm-hmm. The line that you're talking about, I think, is a take on something Chuck D said. And I was just trying to put a spin on a mm-hmm. Chuck D line. I think you're referring to something from...
Yeah,
that song.
Yeah. Okay. Just two more quick things. First off, I was reading that long interview with you in The Believer by the guy who later went on to write Go the Fuck to Sleep, which I thought was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great piece. And you mentioned you like Eugene McDaniels, and you mentioned it earlier today. And I hadn't thought of it before, but once you said it, it made perfect sense. What aspects of his style appeal to you? And how'd you hear about him other than that Beastie Boys sample? It's kind of like he's a pretty obscure artist.
Well, Tribe sampled him. Pete Rock sampled him. Mm-hmm. Beastie Boys sampled him. We sampled him. Large sampled him. And so you start to be like, okay, there's something here. Right. You know, not even in, before you hear the words, like I said, there's something in the harmony, tones of music and instrument choice and melody choice that moves hip-hop artists. And what is it? Okay, you know, the drums are pronounced and there's open bits of music. But then when I finally came to catch that album on tour, I was on tour with Bismarck, and I caught that album in Virginia, I think. And I got home and I listened to it. I was just like, what in the hell? You know, made him write these lyrics, and I suck, and I don't know what I'm doing with my life, and I have to be better. You know what I mean? Like, those songs and those lyrics and that feel is just like, dude, you have to do better. You know, he's saying everything you thought about saying then, before you said it, better. It's moving you. And then the way that he sings and the tones that he uses are doing the same thing that I talked about with Chuck D, in terms of certain, you know, harmonies and tones that my hair would stand up. And then he was politically, you know, socially vocal. He was blacklisted, you know, at that time. You're writing songs
by
that,
Nixon, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're writing songs that are moving the government to the point where they're like, who the fuck is this dude?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I try to sound like him. I try to sing like him.
Yeah, it's amazing. So finally, on the Shut Him Down freestyle, you say 16 bars consume the globe like Galactus. And so, you know, on that kind of comic book note, what'd you think of the Avengers movie?
It was really good, man. I really enjoyed it. I was going to wait for all my friends, my nerd friends, but I was in the gym, and then I just couldn't wait, and it was 11 o'clock, and I was like, I'm going to a matinee by myself. Like, really just geeked out. I was sitting in there, like, by myself, like, hoping somebody isn't, like, okay. But, you know, the way they incorporated different characters and brought them together and strengths and weaknesses and their issues, so to speak, I thought the guy took his time and spelled that out for the avid comic book head and follower, and then the casual fan as well.
Excellent. And we always like to get the people who are here to, you know, do a little bit of, to talk about us for a second. I was wondering if you could tell us your thoughts on Rap Genius. When I met you, you mentioned you'd seen it and looked at it yourself, so.
Stoked, man. You know, oftentimes you go on the net and somebody, you know, print your lyrics out, and they're like very, very, very screwed up. So, first of all, the thought of getting it right or getting it close and getting people's vibe and explanations of what they think is an amazing, amazing idea. So, it's just, you know, looking at Gene stuff, you know, you discover stuff that you didn't even realize, even on the song that we did together. And that's what's brilliant about lyricists. It's like going to a movie, you know, and reading a book and a good piece of art that you can see again or listen to again.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, with Farrell Munch. Thank you so much.
Peace.
All right.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. If you're curious about any of the songs mentioned on this show, audio, lyrics, and explanations can be found on rapgenius.com. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to Toronto's Fourth Pyramid, whose new album, The Pyramid Scheme, was one of the best new releases to cross our desk in quite a while. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. The interview was recorded by Dan Berger. This podcast was engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful Three Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Music by Psionic and Sir Loin. Special thanks to Nicole Witte Solomon. I'm your host, Same Old Sean, and I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.